Welcome to Medicine Matters, the Springer Medicine Podcast. In this episode, we're exploring a subject that is rarely discussed in medical school and avoided or glossed over in our clinics because of social taboos. We're talking about sexual activity and sexual health in older women. Did you know that roughly 50% of women over 50 experience sexual dysfunction? Yet fewer than 20% report it to their doctor. Factors like menopause, chronic conditions, medication side effects, and partner dynamics can all affect a person's sex life as they age. Yet many women suffer in silence, thinking these changes are just part of aging. As doctors, particularly any of you primary care physicians out there, we are perfectly positioned to address these issues and help women lead sexually healthy and fulfilling lives as they age. And we're not just talking about treating UTIs, we're talking about the transformative impact of open and trusting conversations with patients in an environment where sexual health across the lifespan is normalised. By addressing concerns like vaginal dryness, libido changes, and pelvic floor dysfunction early on, we can improve quality of life, we can prevent long-term complications, and we can ensure our patients feel empowered in their sexual health. So, I'm hopeful that once you've heard from our expert today, you'll feel a lot more comfortable having these conversations with your patients, asking them the right questions, and adopting a holistic, patient-centered approach that makes sexual health a priority for your patients, no matter their age. Let's get started. Today, we are talking with Professor Holly Thomas. She is Assistant Professor of Medicine and Clinical and Translational Science at the University of Pittsburgh. Thank you so much for joining us today, Professor Thomas.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
Can I start by asking you to tell us a little bit about your background and your current research interests?
Yes, I'd be glad to. I am a practicing primary care doctor, or a GP, I know, as they call it in some other countries. So I see patients in the clinic. I see both men and women of all ages of adults, and spanning from 18 up to as high as you want. But the majority of my patients are women because I have special training in women's health. And my clinical research focuses on the menopause transition and older age and how sexuality and sexual function may change during that midlife and older age transition.
Wonderful. So one of the reasons why we're so excited to talk to you today is because of your recent publication in Nature Aging, where you were talking about supporting the sexual healthcare needs of aging women. So if I can, let's start with some definitions of what we're talking about today, if that's useful. So in clinical medicine, we often talk about over 65 years of age as being an older adult. But it would appear from what I've been reading that actually sexual health definitions in older adults are much younger than that, perhaps even 45 to 50 years old. So firstly, do we need to put a number on this? And secondly, if we do, what ages are we talking about?
Yeah, that's a great question. So in my publications, when I talk about older age, I'm typically talking about 60 plus or 65 plus. And then when I mention midlife, I'm typically talking about 35 to 40 up to age maybe 60 or 65. And these are key milestones for the health of women, because women often begin going through the menopause transition, what we call perimenopause or the early menopause transition, in their early to mid 40s. And then by their mid 50s, they're usually all through. But the types of sexual problems that are most prevalent or affect people the most can be different in those midlife years versus older age for women.
So are you saying that instead of thinking about a woman's age, we should be focused more on whether she is pre, peri, postmenopausal?
It seems like both things are important. Both age and menopause status play a role in sexual function. So there's interesting work out of Australia, Lorraine Dennerstein's work, where she did longitudinal research to try to disentangle some of the effects, like what is aging and what is menopause status? And it seems like both things play a role. But what was interesting about her work is that the quality of the relationship that a person has with their partner is even more important than, say, like hormone levels, for example. Those types of things were more closely tied to sexual function in midlife women than, say, like their hormone levels. But there are factors that come with aging that can affect sexual function. So, for example, in our work, women talk about the development of pain, joint pain, not sexual pain, but pain in the hip, pain in the knee. And they talk about, I can't maybe enjoy the types of sexual positions that used to work well for me. And so I've had to adapt to that. So that's an aging related change that can affect sexual function. Whereas the things like, for example, the genital changes that can occur that are more related to menopause and hormone levels can also affect sexual function. So certainly both things are important. Maybe that doesn't help our clinicians out as much, but I think understanding where a woman is at with regards to the menopause transition is really important for sexual health and older overall health. So having that conversation, if you have a woman in her late 30s, 40s, you know, early 50s, getting some history about what's going on with her menstrual cycles, is she experiencing any symptoms of menopause, that can really help you understand where she might be at in the transition and shed some light on what sorts of sexual problems might be most likely.
What would you say then are the primary things in terms of sexual dysfunction that you see in those different phases of life?
Yeah, so one of the important things to understand about sexual dysfunction, and this goes back to your question about definitions, is many of the studies looking at prevalence of sexual dysfunction do not account for the amount of distress or bother that is caused by that sexual problem. So in the DSM-5, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual 5, put out by the American Psychiatric Association, it defines sexual dysfunction as a sexual problem that is associated with distress. So this is something that's important for listeners to know, that if somebody's having a sexual symptom, but they're not bothered by it, then that is not defined as a sexual dysfunction. So when we're thinking about the prevalence of sexual problems, we have to distinguish that from the prevalence of sexual dysfunction, because sexual dysfunction requires that distress. So to turn back to the question, when we're talking about women in the age group of, say, 40s to 50s, the most common sexual dysfunction, so that is a sexual symptom that is causing bother or distress, tends to be low libido. Whereas when we're looking at women in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, they may have trouble with low libido, but also very common is sexual pain. And this is because after women go through the menopause transition, they experience decreased levels of estrogen in the body. And this has effects on the genitals, the bladder, the vulva, the vagina. So we can see changes both on the physical exam level, but also on a microscopic level, and also in terms of the microbiome of the vagina. These things all change after women transition through menopause. And these symptoms tend to get worse as women age. So these changes that we see in the vagina, the vulva, can result in vaginal dryness and sexual pain. And so those types of symptoms can be more of a problem in women in those older years.
Right. So what effect do you think that has on sexual activity as women get older? I guess what I'm trying to ask is it predominantly these physiological aspects of sexual dysfunction driving a reduced sexual activity in advancing age, or is it more psychological or even more rooted in societal expectations and norms?
That's a great question. So you bring up one important point, that sexual dysfunctions can be linked. So obviously, if somebody's experiencing sexual pain, the sexual activity is going to be less satisfying, less fulfilling. And so in my own work that we've done doing interviews with women in this age group, they do point to sexual pain leading to low libido because sex isn't pleasurable and therefore they're less inclined to have it. But to answer your other question in regards to frequency of sexual activity or whether or not they're sexually active, so we do know that the proportion of women who are sexually active does tend to go down with age. And we also know that for those who are sexually active, the frequency of sexual activity also tends to go down with age. So people report having sex less frequently. What is important to know about this is that whether or not somebody has a partner is a really important factor in that. So we see really big differences in rates of sexual activity for women who have a current romantic partner versus women who do not. So a big proportion of women who become sexually inactive as they get older, it's because they no longer have a romantic partner. And there is a small subset of women, maybe like 10% in the midlife and older age group, who will be sexually active outside the context of a romantic relationship. But for the majority of midlife and older women, when they're sexually active, it's in the context of a romantic relationship. So if a relationship ends because of divorce, separation, or even death of a partner, that has a big impact on whether women are sexually active or not.
Okay, so let's cover some epidemiology then, if we can. You said just now that the proportion of women who are sexually active does tend to go down with age. What data do we have around that?
Yeah, so when we're looking at women in midlife, if they have a sexual partner available, around 60 to 70% are sexually active. The numbers are a little bit lower if they don't have a romantic partner. And then even when we're looking at women in their 70s and 80s, we can see that if they have a partner, around a third, like 30 to 40% are still reporting that they're sexually active. So, you know, when we're seeing somebody in the clinic that's, you know, in their 70s or 80s, we may assume that they're no longer sexually active. That can often be incorrect, especially if they still have a romantic partner. They may be having sex less frequently than when they were younger, but many are still sexually active.
Great. Okay. So I'm happy we've been able to bust the myth that older age equals asexuality, but, and I'm sorry, I keep dragging you back to definitions, but what do you mean when you say sexually active? Are we talking solely about intercourse or broader terms of intimacy?
Obviously, sexual activity can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. When we do research with this age group, we typically define sexual activity pretty broadly. So that could be penetrative sex, but it could also include oral sex or intimate touching. One of the things that we do know is that as women become older, they're more likely to engage in other types of sexual activity besides penetrative intercourse.
Interesting. Do you think that's because of what we talked about earlier regarding the issues around older women experiencing more pain during sex?
Yes, that certainly seems to be the case. And people alluded to this even in some of the research that we've done. Again, when we did individual interviews and focus groups with women in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, they talked about, because of that dryness that can develop, that things like oral sex might be more pleasurable than penetrative sex due to those changes that they experienced. The other thing that's important to point out is that obviously, you know, for most people, sexual activity is occurring in context with a partner. For many of our patients, that partner is male. And if their male partner is getting older, then the male partner may be developing sexual problems of his own that might have a negative impact on the sexual function of the couple. So for example, in our research, women talk about the sexual partner developing some erectile dysfunction. It's harder to maintain an erection as long. But then the woman talks about, well, it takes me longer to reach orgasm than when I was younger. So it's kind of a perfect storm for unsatisfying sex if both partners are developing this sort of sexual dysfunction that can compound one another. But what we also saw from our research is that those couples that were able to communicate about it and potentially shift the type of sexual activity that they were engaging in could still maintain satisfying sex, even if some of those physical barriers were developing.
So you've just touched on a really important clarification that we should make, and that's to be clear who it is that we are talking about in this podcast. So we're predominantly referring to women in heterosexual relationships. Is that right?
It's a good opportunity to make mention that I use the term women when I talk about my research quite a bit. And I'm usually referring to cisgender women when I talk about my research. But of course, there are folks that weren't assigned female at birth that are considered women. And we don't know as much as we would like to about the experiences of gender minorities with menopause and older age, and particularly with sexuality. We definitely need more work in that space because it's very important to understand that. So when I'm speaking about my research, I'm typically talking about cisgender women. There is some research into sexual minority women, so particularly like lesbian and bisexual women and their experiences with sexuality and the menopause transition. From the research that we have, interestingly, it suggests that lesbian women tend to have more resilience when it comes to sexual function during aging and the menopause transition. The degree of sexual problems and the bothersomeness of sexual problems seems to be less for lesbian women, although again, the research is relatively scant. And we think that this may be because lesbian women, women who partner with women, they've probably developed stronger skills in communicating with their partners, what they like, what they don't like. They've had to adapt to different types of sexual activity with their partners. It's not when a lesbian woman is partnering with somebody, it's not assumed that it's going to be penetrative intercourse. There has to be some talk and negotiation and figuring out about that. So if there are physical changes occurring as women move through midlife, perhaps lesbian women are just more comfortable being able to communicate about sex, being able to adapt to different kinds of sex compared to heterosexual women.
So now, if I may focus in on some of the psychological considerations, what are the effects of either sustained sexual activity or conversely inactivity on the mental health and general well-being of older women?
This can be difficult to tell from the research. So certainly there's plenty of research that links sexual activity to physical and mental health and well-being, but it's kind of a chicken and the egg question. So are women who are having more sex, is that resulting in greater physical and mental health? Or are women who are already healthy, both physically and mentally, more likely to engage in sex? And the answer is it's probably a little bit of both. But when you look at these things cross-sectionally, we definitely see a link, a strong link between physical and mental health and sexual activity. What we do know is that for women who are experiencing sexual dysfunction, so a sexual problem that's actually resulting in bother or distress, that can go on to have negative impacts, especially on their relationship with their partner. So women who are experiencing bothersome low libido, for example, will frequently report feelings of guilt, feelings that they're letting their partner down, So these things can be really challenging for women who are experiencing them.
So thinking about some of the messaging we're giving our patients, for older women who are sexually active, what considerations do they need to have around safe and healthy sex? Is the information that we are giving them, should it be the same as what we say to younger women?
Here in the US, we certainly know that older adults are not exempt from sexually transmitted infections. It's something that can certainly occur at any age. And earlier we spoke about women who are losing a partner to death, separation, divorce. Some of those women may go on to gain a new partner in later life. That certainly happens. And they're having to engage in a conversation that maybe they haven't had to engage in for decades about how do we make sure that we stay healthy while we're being intimate. So it can be really an interesting stage in life. From a public health standpoint, I think just understanding that these are problems that can affect somebody at any age. Nobody's necessarily immune from it. And we know the things that help protect people from sexually transmitted infections, such as condom use, pre-exposure prophylaxis with regards to HIV. And so I think that messaging is really important.
I'm interested to know then, from your primary care perspective, how do you think doctors can best support older adults with their sexual health?
This is a lovely question. I think just making the ask as a starting point, I find it pretty easy to slip in a question when I'm taking the social history. So, you know, you're asking the patient about their relationships, if they're still pregnancy capable, you're asking about their thoughts about pregnancy intention. You can also ask a simple question such as, are you having any sexual problems these days? And if the person answers yes, you can collect some more information about that. Again, degree of bother, you know, how much it's impacting them. It's pretty quick to slip that question in. And patients, when I ask them, don't seem to be taken aback when I ask it as part of the sexual history. And so they appreciate being asked about it, because a lot of women don't know very much about particularly the vaginal changes that can occur with aging and the menopause transition. It's estimated that about 80% of women will develop vaginal changes postmenopausally, which is a huge number, but most women are not aware of this, and most women are not aware that it's related to menopause. And most women are definitely not aware that there's lots of safe and effective treatment options for those changes. And so when I ask that question about sexual problems, sometimes women will be like, well, yeah, things, you know, are drier, or, you know, a little bit more painful, or I've noticed some vaginal narrowing. And then that opens up a whole conversation about, okay, well, is that bothering you? Well, let's talk, because here's some ideas I have about how to improve that if it's something that's having a negative impact on you. Certainly there are patients that notice those changes, but it's not impacting them. You know, they're like, that chapter of my life has passed. It's not, sex is not a high priority for me right now. I'm okay with things as they stand, and that's okay too.
And what would some of those solutions be for the most common problems that you see in your clinics?
Right. So if we're talking about the vaginal dryness, the sexual pain, usually we'll talk to patients about over-the-counter moisturizers and lubricants. And many women have tried these already by the time they've come into the clinic to talk about these problems, but some have not. One thing that's important for clinicians to discuss with patients is that vaginal moisturizers are something that's intended to be used every day to relieve symptoms of vaginal dryness, whereas lubricants are something to be used just for sexual activity. And so it's important for clinicians to counsel women about the difference between those products and to not use them for the purpose that the other was intended for. So that's usually the starting point. But if a person's not getting sufficient relief from that approach, oftentimes various vaginal estrogen products can be really helpful for those type of symptoms. And then sometimes what we see is that if women have been dealing with sexual pain for a long time, they may develop some spasm of the pelvic floor muscles, what's often termed vaginismus, that make it difficult to participate in penetrative intercourse, or there can be some shrinkage of the tissues of the vagina that can also make it difficult to participate in intercourse. And there's actually physical therapists that specialize in the pelvic floor, that they've done extra training and this is what they do every day. I understand that in some other countries, pelvic floor physical therapists are used much more commonly, but here in the US, women and sometimes even other doctors are gobsmacked to hear about this from me. They had no idea that this existed. But even my patients who are skeptical, you know, if I can convince them and they go, they usually end up seeing how helpful it was. So a pelvic floor physical therapist can help both with, you know, some of that muscle spasm that may be occurring, or that narrowing and shrinkage of tissues that may be occurring. So if you have that available, it's a great resource.
Absolutely. It's a very effective and also low cost intervention. An important one to consider. And then finally, I would love to know what you think the future priorities, future directions are in this field. So if we were recording this conversation in 5 years' time, what outstanding questions would you like to have the answers to?
This is a great question. So difficulties with libido still remain a challenging problem for women across a lot of different age groups, but the prevalence of bothersome low libido is actually highest in our midlife women. And that can still be challenging to treat. There are, at least here in the US, some FDA-approved medications for low libido, but they're costly and they can have some side effects and medication interactions that might be concerning, especially for women in midlife or older age who might have other health problems or might be on other medications that make these medications more difficult to use. There's a growing body of research supporting the use of non-pharmaceutical psychological interventions to help women with low libido, particularly mindfulness meditation. So then there's been a lot of work by a researcher named Lori Brado at the University of British Columbia looking at the use of, you know, teaching women mindfulness meditation in order to improve their libido with some impressive effects. The challenge is how to get those types of treatments available to more people. And so I think some of the things that are being looked at is, can this work if it's delivered virtually? Can this work if it was, say, delivered by an artificial intelligence? So those types of questions of, if we know something works, how can we get it to more people in need? The other interesting question is, if we know these things work, how actually are they working? If mindfulness is helpful for low libido in women, through what mechanism is that achieving that? Is it through improvements in sleep? Is it through improvements in mood? Is it through other avenues which we haven't explored yet? So for me personally, that's a very interesting future avenue, and I hope we'll know more in 5 or 10 years.
Professor Thomas, this has been a fascinating conversation. Honestly, I could continue for hours, but we will wrap it up there. So I just want to say thank you again. I really appreciate you making the time to join me today.
Thanks for having me. It's been a blast.
This podcast is intended for healthcare professionals for their ongoing medical education and entertainment. It should not replace the professional advice of a doctor or pharmacist and may not be used as a basis for diagnosis or any change to the prescribed treatment of disease. The views expressed by our moderators and guests are their opinions and do not represent the position of any third parties. The information given in the podcast is subject to change as the scientific field and clinical advances progress.